From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. In the high-stakes world of thoroughbred racing, many successful jockeys punish their bodies through sweating and purging to keep their weight down. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Shane Sellers, one of the sport's top riders, who's trying to change working conditions for jockeys. He's featured in a new HBO documentary. Also, currents of resistance in China. We meet Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ian Johnson. In his new book, Wild Grass, he tells stories of ordinary Chinese citizens who take on the communist government on issues of corruption, taxation, and religious freedom. And critic-at-large John Powers reviews two American films influenced by Asian cinema recently released on DVD, Kill Bill Volume 1 and Lost in Translation. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld says troops who've had their tours in Iraq extended won't face more extensions. Rumsfeld says if General John Abbasi, the commander of U.S. forces in Iraq, wants troop levels to remain at about 135,000, replacements will be found.
In the event General Abbasi feels that higher number of 135,000 instead of 115,000 troops in country are needed, we've made arrangements to have them replaced, the 20,000 replaced by other forces.
April has been the deadliest month for U.S. forces in Iraq since the U.S.-led invasion was launched 13 months ago. There have been close to 100 U.S. combat deaths this month. It's estimated that between 8 and 11,000 Iraqi civilians have been killed since the war started. Iraqi security forces and civilians began returning to the city of Fallujah today following an agreement handed out yesterday between U.S.-led forces and local leaders. Civilians are allowed to return to the city as long as there are no further attacks on U.S. Marines and insurgents begin handing over their weapons. Eric Kneeler of member station KPBS is with the 1st Marine Division in Fallujah. He says the Marines are ready to take offensive action if the current ceasefire breaks down.
They've beefed up some of their defenses and so forth. They actually built a 3-mile earthen berm from one part of the city to the other to sort of give them better visibility of people who may be sneaking out. So they feel that any sorts of violation of this ceasefire will be cause for heading back into the city and continuing the combat actions that were just in effect 10 days ago.
Eric Kneeler of member station KPBS. Halliburton today confirmed that three bodies found after an attack on a supply convoy in Iraq earlier this month were contract workers for the company. The Federal Reserve Board Chairman Alan Greenspan appeared before members of the Senate Banking Committee, NPR's Jack Speer reports.
Notwithstanding a spate of bank mergers which have shrunk the industry by 40% since the mid-80s, Greenspan told lawmakers overall competitiveness in the financial services industry remains intact. In addition to talking about banking, he also tackled a number of economic questions, telling Committee Chairman Richard Shelby he's optimistic about prospects for the economy and jobs creation.
Things have picked back up again. March was a good month. We moved into April with retail sales doing reasonably well.
On another matter, the Fed chairman said he believes the possibility of deflation, a scenario where prices fall rapidly, is no longer an issue. Greenspan gave no hint on the future direction of interest rates, though most analysts don't expect the Fed to take any action on rates at its next meeting in May. Jack Speer, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR. In Israel, dozens of anti-nuclear campaigners, mostly from Europe, staged a vigil outside Mordechai Vanunu's prison today. This comes a day before the former nuclear technician is to be released from his 18-year jail term for divulging secrets about Israel's nuclear bomb technology. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports.
In our hearts, peace, salam, shalom.
Vanunu has become an icon for anti-nuclear campaigners who gathered to praise him as a courageous whistleblower who alerted the world to Israel's nuclear program. Inside Israel, however, he is widely reviled as an atomic spy who disclosed state secrets to the Sunday Times of London. Vanunu recently told Shin Bet officers that Dimona ought to be destroyed. The Israeli government continues to regard Vanunu as a security security risk with secrets yet to disclose. And upon his release, Vanunu is barred from leaving the country and from approaching sea and airports and foreign embassies. All restrictions on his freedom, his family says they will appeal. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Jerusalem.
A former Indonesian general indicted for alleged human rights abuses in East Timor was nominated today as the presidential candidate of the party of the former dictator Suharto. The former general, Wiranto, who uses only one name, was chosen by party officials at a convention in Jakarta. In a major policy reversal, British Prime Minister Tony Blair today pledged to hold a referendum on the European Union's constitution. Blair didn't set a date for the referendum, but he said it wouldn't be held for at least a year. I'm Nancy Marshall, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sundance Channel, premiering the weekly original series Anatomy of a Scene, with the making of The United States of Leland, tonight at 9.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. When the Kentucky Derby runs May 1st, my guest Shane Sellers will once again be in the saddle. One of the top riders of thoroughbred racing, Sellers will ride in his 15th Derby. He's had more than 20,000 starts and has won 2 Breeders' Cups. But he's also endured the physical punishment riders often inflict on themselves to keep their weight low enough to compete at racing's highest level. And he was out of racing for 2 years after a devastating knee injury. A new documentary about the sometimes grueling life of the racetrack premieres Monday on HBO. It's called Jockey, and Sellers is one of 3 riders featured in the film. Sellers is spearheading a campaign to raise weight limits for riders and improve their working conditions. Some racetracks are raising their minimum weight limits from 113 to 116 pounds. It's only 3 pounds, but a big difference to riders struggling with their weight. A recent 5-year study of the overall health of jockeys found they have 5 times the rate of respiratory infection of the general population and 10 times the incidence of kidney damage caused by chronic dehydration and malnutrition. One of the jockeys featured in the HBO documentary is Randy Romero, who's been nominated this year to the Racing Hall of Fame. He's currently waiting to be put on the donors list for a kidney. Another is a young apprentice jockey, Chris Rozier.
People quit smoking, people quit drinking, but heaving is the hardest thing to me. It's the hardest thing in the world to quit. I've tried dieting, I've tried quitting, but it always seems just when you think you're doing good, somebody wants to go to eat, and you're sitting there and you're looking at the menu, it's like, man, I want this big cheeseburger, I want this steak, and it's hard. And it's something I wish I would never started. And a lot of my older riders told me never started. But it's something I grew up around watching, and I wanted to do it bad enough, so I took the easy way.
I spoke to Shane Sellers last week. Well, Shane Sellers, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
You mentioned in the HBO piece that a lot of jockeys don't have a lot of education, and this is sort of their way out. Was that true with you?
Yeah. I went to the 12th grade. I mean, I didn't have no choice. My dad made me promise that I'd finish high school, and I did. I went to at least 2 weeks before graduation, and he saw that riding. I was riding at racehorses at night, going to school in the morning. Well, I'd get up in the morning, actually, go and work horses, gallop them in the morning, then go straight to school, come home, and then we had night racing at Delta Downs. And so I did the both of them until, again, 2 weeks before my graduation, and then he just saw that riding was going to be my life, and he let me quit.
Tell us what it's like to be riding a 1,000-pound animal at blinding speed around a track in a pack of people. Give us a sense of what it feels like to ride in a race.
It's quite a rush, and the thing about it is that you're on such a big animal, and you only weigh 112 to 115 pounds, and you have to guide that animal, and you're surrounded by other horses, and you're depending on those riders on those other horses to guide those horses around, and it's an adrenaline rush. I mean, especially when you're in a position that there's a certain point in the race where you just know you're going to win. And there's a position point in the time where you know that you're not going to win. So it goes both ways, but there's no feeling like it.
There's a ton of noise. You got mud coming up in your face?
Yeah. Yeah, if you're in back, there's a lot of mud thrown back at you. Some days, if it's muddy, it's really sloppy, and you got to wear more goggles, and hopefully you don't run out of goggles. There's noise, but I don't think you really hear the noise because you're so concentrating on what you're doing at the time, and I'm paying attention to the horses in front of me, and particularly where the horses I think are that I have to beat in the race. Say in some instances I'm stuck behind two or three horses that I know that are dying in the race, not really dying, but I mean, or just out of horse, and they're backing up in my face, and I need to find a way to get out from around them and get back into the race. If I see a horse that's gonna is stuck behind a horse and he gets out and makes a move, I want to take that position. Just positioning yourself to win, it's not the easiest thing to do, and sometimes it's not exactly like you planned it out in your head. I mean, you always go out there with a game plan, but sometimes, and most of the time when the gates open, sometimes, those plans are out the door right away. Say your horse stumbles out of the gate. You thought you was going to be the speed of the race, and oops, my horse stumbled. Now I'm laying fifth. Now what do I do? And so sometimes you got to go to plan B, and you have to think of many different scenarios and run that race different kind of ways in your head, because it doesn't always happen the way you think it's going to happen.
That moment that we've all seen when the horses are in the gate and there's a minute or so when they're getting everybody settled in, ready to go, what are you feeling at that moment?
I'm just first and foremost trying to be calm on my horse, because they're so fractious in the gate. All they know is run, and they're waiting for that gate and anticipating that gate to open. So some of them get high strung. So, there's a calmness you have to have in you, and the calmer you are in your horse, the calmer he's going to be. But at the same time, your mind is running different ways. What's going to happen, what I'm going to do here. I'm playing that race out in my head, I'm wanting to do this, I'm wanting to do that. You're still playing that race out in your head. That way when the scenario does happen, you know exactly what to do, and you don't have to think about it, because you don't have time to think about it. That's I think what makes some riders better than others. They don't think. They just react upon their instincts.
You mentioned the horses are jittery because they want to run. How do you communicate that to them, that they need to calm down? Is it by patting them? Is it talking to them?
Different ways. Just the calmness. You're tense on the horse and they're tense up, and horses have mane, and you have to hold on to that mane. But when they break, well, I never grab the mane until right before, because when you grab that mane, they know that they're fixing to kick them. And that's one thing I don't do. And I see some riders grabbing mane right when they go in there, and you can see their horses just start to get jittery with them. And I don't. I don't touch their mane until right before the last horse is going in. I kind of grab it really soft and try to leave there. It's just being calm, just a calmness. Horses know. They're not stupid animals. And you get on them, you have a calmness about you. You can just feel them. You can just feel them relax. It's like they take a deep breath and, everything's all right,
What weight did you ride at? Or do you ride at?
I used to ride at 113 until I got hurt. And when I came back off of my injury, we were all fighting to change the weights. I honestly couldn't do 13 anymore. I mean, I had never been off of riding more than 2 or 3 weeks, on a vacation, and I was off 2 years. So my body blew up to probably what my normal body weight was 135 strip. That's, naked. So to get back to riding, to do 13, I had to get down to 110 pounds, and I just couldn't lose it. And then at the same time, I wanted to practice what I preach. If I was going to fight for the weight being what we was fighting for, was trying to make it 116 minimum, I said, well, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to weigh 116. And so what I ride at now is 117. It's comfortable for me. I still have to get in the box and pull a couple pounds, but I don't have to heave. I don't have to take Lasix anymore, and I'm much stronger when I go into the box, and I'm much stronger when I ride, and it hasn't hurt my business one bit at all.
Now, you used a couple of terms there, the box, Lasix. Let's back up a little, and when you were trying to ride at 113, you know, if I'm doing the math right, that's 22 pounds below what might have been your normal body weight. What did you do to keep your weight down?
Oh, there was many methods. What I did early in my career was I was taught to heave, which is regurgitate your food, and which is unfortunate. I was a young kid, and I didn't know how to. I mean, when I first started, I weighed 116, and I needed, as an apprentice, you get in lighter than journeyman, so I had to weigh 107, 108 with my tack, so that meant I had to be 104. And I said, well, what am I going to do here? And the older riders just, they taught me how to heave.
What is the box?
The box is a hot box, a sweat box, a sauna. You know, some people might go in for 5 or 10 minutes to loosen up. We get in them for hours, you know, a day to lose 3, 4, 5 pounds. Now you go sit in there and I've never seen you, but I'm sure if you go in there and try to pull a pound and you see how it feels, and you're talking about we get in there and we're already starving to death, you know, when we go in there, we're already underweight, and then we go in there and stay in there and pull 2 and 3 pounds. It's tough. It's tough, and we do it because we love the sport, and if we didn't do it, there wouldn't be no horse racing. You know, bottom line, if you took the hot boxes out of the jock's room and everything else, and you said the riders are not going to heave, they're not going to take Lasix, you'd have a handful of riders who could ride. You'd have maybe a handful.
You take Lasix. What is that? What does it do to you?
I don't take Lasix anymore. I did. Lasix is I guess what they give to heart patients to take fluid off. And if you take a Lasix, I mean, you urinate very, very much. So I mean, you could lose 2, 3 pounds taking one Lasix.
So when you were...
But it's not good at all for your body. I mean, it's horrible.
So when you were doing this before, and you'd ride several races in a day, would you heave every day? Would you heave several times a day?
Sure. Early in my career, I would heave. I would hit the box. Sometimes I would do all three,
and
go out and ride 7, 8, 9 races a day.
What are the long term effects of that kind of behavior?
I really don't know. I'll tell you the longer term effects is what's happening to Randy Romero right now.
He is one of racing's best known and most successful jockeys, and he quite ill, right?
Very ill. Yes.
There's a scene in the HBO film where you walk through a training room. I believe you called it jail. It evokes a kind of a queasy feeling for you to go in there, right?
Yeah, that's the hot box. Yeah. That's the hot box.
And there's a special tub for a special kind of commode, I guess, for heaving, right? That tracks have installed, right?
Well, some tracks have, yes. Most tracks have. I mean, Churchill Downs has a heaving bowl. Arlington Park has one. So I mean, racetracks know that they're not naive about what you're doing. You know, they put the facilities there for you to do what you have to do to take your weight off.
My guest is thoroughbred jockey Shane Sellers. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is one of thoroughbred racing's top riders, Shane Sellers. He's one of three featured on the new documentary film Jockey, which premieres next week on HBO. Shane Sellers, tell us what the rules are about a jockey's weight and who sets them.
Well, every state sets it. The horse racing board in every state sets it. And you know, and it's according to what they want. And now in the last year or two, there have been places that make the bottom 16. I know at Keeneland, they make the bottom. You don't see many horses getting in with lighter than 116. Arlington Park, New Orleans, Fairgrounds in New Orleans. But there are some racetracks that don't want. And the CHRB, which is the California Horse Racing Board, they're going to make changes. And they're going to make significant changes to the weights because of the studies that are there. Now, it's going to be fascinating or interesting to see how many racetracks other than them are going to do it.
Let me ask you, you've said that you need to get the minimum weights changed. Why is that?
I really don't care what they do with the top weight. I just want the minimum changed because I don't want to have to do, you know, if the bottom's 13, well, then if I got a guy that's willing to go and kill himself to do 13 and I do 17 and we're fighting for the same horse, well, that owner say if he's getting with 13, he said, well, I'll ride Joe Schmo because he can do 13. I'm not going to ride Sellers because he's 17 and I'm going to have to carry 3 pounds over. Some guys are willing to risk their health to make 13. All riders wanted to bring the minimum up so we don't have to have that, that fight amongst each other. The bottom 16, it's 16. You can't do no lighter. You know, it puts us all in the same boat. And you know what? Racing, it'll be much better for racing. We have strong trainers will have stronger riders, and it'd be much more better for horse racing in general.
Period. I got to tell you, 116 sounds awfully light still to me. Is that where it should be?
You can't make it too heavy. I mean, you can't go out there and have linebackers up upon your horse. I'm not that naive. We're not that naive. But the scale of weights have been for 100 years.
So the only way to make it have a fair competition is to say you can't ride unless you're up to a certain weight, because if you're allowed to come in at a lower weight, then the owners will pick the lighter weight guys, forcing people like you to abuse your bodies.
Exactly. Most of us ride at 2 to 3% body fat, and anything below 5% is detrimental to your health. What we're trying to do and what we will do eventually is grandfather the guys that are in already that have been riding. But, you know, like in 2005, we're going to try to make it to where any jockey that gets a license cannot ride under 5% body fat. It's because it's detrimental to your health. And that's what we're going to fight for. Not Shane Sellers, not Randy Romero, but every rider in America as a jockey's organization, as our jockey's guild, our organization is going to fight for that. That a rider, he cannot ride if he's under 5% body weight. And that's for the young riders coming in to protect them from doing any more harm to their bodies.
Shane Sellers, tell us about the injury that took you out of racing.
The injury happened at the fairgrounds in Louisiana, and I was aboard a two-year-old for Claiborne Farms and trained by Frankie Brothers, who was my main client. And he spooked from another horse. He had never run before. He was a very young horse. And he spooked from a horse and unseated me, which I landed on my feet. But in fear that he would hurt himself or hurt somebody else, you know, because they'll get to running around and just don't have nowhere to go. And I grabbed him on the offside and by the rein, and I held on to him, and he drugged me for a piece, and I probably should have never have grabbed him. I should have just let the outrider grab him. But, you know, again, we love these animals. We love the game of horse racing, and I didn't want to see anybody get hurt. And I grabbed him, and I held on him. I used bad judgment, and I held on him way too long, and I fell underneath him, and he stepped on my left knee and just ruined my career.
What did it feel like?
It was a horrible feeling. I remember him stepping on the left side of my knee, and just like a crack block, it just ripped everything in my knee, and it was the most horrific pain I ever had in my life. And when it happened, I when you're walking around and you bump your arm on something, or first thing you want to do is rub it off and make sure everything is okay. And when I felt it, I got to my feet, and I just thought, let me get to my feet and see if I can walk. And when I took a step on my leg, my kneecap went the other way, and I just fell down, and I just cried from the pain, and I cried because I knew at that moment my career was over.
What was it like to be out of racing? I mean, you had to get an operations, I assume, and a lot of rehabilitation, and for that time you had to be away from the track, or at least know you weren't going to ride again. What was that like?
It was horrible. I went through depression. I went through my family suffered, because I was home all the time. I just got to where I couldn't get out the house. I didn't want to get out the house. I never knew nothing else but riding horses, and the thought of me having to do something else, I didn't know what to do, and it was a pretty scary moment in my life, probably the scariest moment in my life.
Were you financially strapped?
No, I had a great career and I saved my money. I mean, it wasn't, and thank God that I had a disability policy, which most riders can't afford. But I've had some good people, thank God, point me in the right direction financially and force me to get a disability policy, and I had one, so I had an income every month. But that's another thing that riders can't, 80% of riders cannot afford a disability policy, and if you don't have one, when you fall, you have no income coming in. But I was fortunate enough to have a disability policy.
One of the characters in the HBO documentary is a youngster named Chris Rozier who wants to become a jockey, and you and some others kind of give him some advice. I'm wondering if your kids wanted to pursue a career as a jockey, would you let them?
Never. And I've purposely kept my kids away from horse racing, not because I don't like the game, but in fear that they would want to ride. And I don't want to see them go through what I go through every day. I'll do it because it's what I've done. But there's too many things. I mean, a month ago, one of my friends got killed riding. You know, he fell on an accident. He got killed. It's a very, very dangerous profession.
Have they shown any interest to your kids? I mean, they must be excited at what their dad does, no?
They are, but they don't have any interest at all. They like horses, but I keep them away from it. I let them come for the big days, but I always tell them, just enjoy watching Daddy, and you're going to do something else. You're going to play baseball. You're going to play football. You're going to do whatever. You're going to be a kid. You're not going to be anything remotely close to a jockey.
Well, Shane Sellers, thanks so much for speaking with us.
All right, thanks a lot.
Thoroughbred jockey Shane Sellers, who'll be riding Cliff's Edge, one of the favorites at this year's Kentucky Derby. Sellers is one of three riders profiled in the documentary Jockey, which opens tonight at the Philadelphia Film Festival and appears Monday on HBO. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
I disappeared one morning, left without a warning. Some thought I was finally gone for good. Those doubters just got rattled.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the Sundance Channel, premiering the weekly original series Anatomy of a Scene with the making of The United States of Leland, tonight at 9. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, stories of ordinary Chinese citizens fighting the communist government. We'll talk with Ian Johnson, author of Wild Grass, Three Stories of Change in Modern China. And John Powers reviews two recently released DVDs, Sofia Coppola's Lost in Translation and Quentin Tarantino's Kill Bill Volume 1. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. It's been 15 years since Americans watched in horror as Chinese troops crushed student protests in Beijing's Tiananmen Square, killing hundreds. My guest, journalist Ian Johnson, writes that Chinese authoritarian one-party state is again beset with protests, the product of economic reforms that have given Chinese families more income, more education, and new aspirations. As Beijing's correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, Ian Johnson won a Pulitzer Prize in 2001 for his reporting on the government's repression of the Falun Gong spiritual movement. He is now the journal's Berlin bureau chief. Johnson's new book, Wild Grass, tells three stories of Chinese citizens who've taken on the government over excessive taxation, corruption, and denial of religious freedom. We began with a reading.
China's rulers have developed a bad case of the nerves. Unemployment is high. Corruption permeates daily life, and relations with the outside world result in recurring crises. Often these tensions erupt in small protests, sometimes against the government, oftentimes against outsiders. They usually end after a few days, often crushed, sometimes petering out when a few ringleaders are arrested and the protesters' demands partly met. But they are never resolved, surfacing like a corpse that won't stay under. When the anniversaries of these protests come around a year later, commemorations are held and petitions delivered. Some of these grudge dates are intensely local, a family's memory of its house torn down to make way for a corrupt real estate project, or a village that commemorates a local leader arrested for standing up to abuse. Other commemorations are shared by millions, the killing of students or the banning of a popular religion. The government, ever watchful for challenges to its rule, tries to keep track of all of them. Protests, arrests, detentions, each year the victims try to commemorate these disasters, and each year the government tightens up around these dates. Slowly, the country's mental calendar has become a series of overlapping scabs and sores.
Ian Johnson, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks.
The three cases that you detail in your book, Wild Grass, all involve, they're different kinds of content. We have peasants who are angry about unfair taxation. In one story, in another, we have people who are protesting the way development's happening in Beijing, where they're being thrown out of their homes and not getting compensation. And then you have the repression of the kind of religious and spiritual group, the Falun Gong. In each of these cases, we have citizens who go to court to seek redress of their grievances. I mean, they're allowed to file petitions and seek some due process. And I think a lot of Americans who know relatively little about China would be surprised to hear that there are courts they can go to. What's the state of due process there for citizens?
Well, that's one of the contradictory and really fascinating developments in China, that there is a legal system that's being developed. China has passed scores and scores of laws, marriage law, contract law, all kinds of laws, and it set up a sort of rough and ready legal system. And in some cases, people can challenge the government. You don't sue the government for fundamental human rights or constitutional rights, but you can challenge the government on some basic problems that maybe the government has made a bad decision in assessing your taxes or hasn't fairly compensated you for tearing down your house, something like that. In those cases, you can challenge the government in court.
Well, one of the successful challenges occurred in the mid-90s. There were these peasants in, and I may get the name wrong, Peijuan, do I have the name right?
Yeah, that's about right.
They felt that they were being overtaxed by corrupt local officials. They hired a lawyer, drafted a petition, and won.
Yeah, it was a really interesting case. There had been a drought that had wiped out the crops in this region of China, this western remote hilly region, and the local officials had simply demanded the normal taxes. The locals said, "We don't have any money to pay the taxes." And the officials had simply gone into their homes and taken away their private belongings, things like televisions or whatever they owned, and said, "Okay, we're taking this in lieu of taxes." And the peasants got angry, pooled some money, and hired a lawyer, and were able to sue the government and win. However, when another group of peasants tried to do the same thing the next valley over, they lost.
Now, was the case that they had as strong as the successful complaint by the peasants in Pejuan?
Yeah, it was basically an identical case. What had happened was the party had a campaign going at that time to tell local officials that they shouldn't abuse their power with the peasants and they shouldn't overtax the peasants. And so the first case won. And then all of a sudden, all these other groups of peasants said, well, we want to sue too. We were also overtaxed. And the government went, holy smokes, we have potentially millions of peasants suing us. So they just cut it off and said, okay, one group can win. We can use that for a little propaganda campaign, but we're not fundamentally going to allow a precedent to be set here. And so they just stopped.
When the peasants formed a group to press their case for relief from these burdensome taxes, it's interesting. They gave it a name. They called it the County Farmers Anti-Corruption and Reducing Tax Burden Volunteer Liaison Small Group. Now, that's a quaint-sounding name, but I gather that that set of words was intended to convey particular messages. What did the name mean?
Well, the name was, first of all, a couple of slogans. They were reducing the peasants' burden, reducing the tax rate, which was an official government policy. And also, by using the word small group, it makes it seem like sort of an unofficial, not some sort of an organization, because all organizations have to be registered with the party. So they called it a small group to make it seem like some sort of informal meeting of people and make it seem less threatening to the government.
Now, when Mr. Ma, the attorney for the peasants, made his way to Beijing, he wasn't just greeted with argument, right?
No, he was beaten and sent to prison and sent back to this region where he came from, where he was then put on trial.
When you interviewed his wife, she had a knapsack with a towel, right, and some documents.
Yeah, she had his bag, his sort of briefcase, and it was filled with, it had the article and the legal daily, which he carried around very proudly to show that he wasn't doing anything wrong, and it had a couple of books on rule of law in China, on the legal system, but it also had this bloody towel that he'd used to staunch the bleeding in his mouth.
When the criminal trial for Mr. Hua occurred, there were some pretty outrageous abuses of due process. I mean, witnesses were intimidated. There was denial of access to records. It really looked like a sham. And I found myself wondering, why would the government hold a trial at all? I mean, isn't it more damaging to their credibility to kind of offer a forum that appears to grant some kind of fairness, but then make it a sham? Why not simply rule by fiat? Why not simply throw people in jail without trials?
Yeah, that's one of the paradoxical developments in China. The government is trying to set up this legal system, and so they feel they have to use it. So they had a trial for him, and as you say, it was largely a sham, but it gave Mr. Ma a chance to write down a fairly impassioned defense, one that was later photocopied and passed around among lawyers in that part of the country. And I guess the government, the basic problem is the government uses the legal system to rule the country. There's sort of the concept of rule of law, and that's where the law is supreme. Everybody has to follow the law. Here, the government is following rule by law, where it uses the legal system to rule the country. And I think here you see this is quite a distinction, quite an important distinction.
Tens of thousands of peasants signed this petition, and I'm sure dozens were actively involved, maybe hundreds, maybe thousands, and they saw their economic grievances ignored and their leaders jailed. What do you think the effect, long-term effect, was on them and their sort of political consciousness?
Well, when I talked to peasants there, they felt, to use the cliche, they felt empowered. They felt that they had really stood up to the government. And even if they lost the case, they still felt, and I think it's probably true, that local officials wouldn't treat them again in such a cavalier fashion, that they would think twice before breaking down their doors and taking away their possessions. because they had created such a ruckus. Okay, they lost, but you can argue that change happens often, but the people at the cutting edge of change aren't always successful. But in the long run, they do push the envelope of change.
My guest is journalist Ian Johnson. His book is Wild Grass, Three Stories of Change in Modern China. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Ian Johnson. He won a Pulitzer Prize in 2001 for his reporting on China. His new book, Wild Grass, tells three stories of citizen activism in modern China. Well, Ian Johnson, a very compelling story in your book is involves the Chinese repression of the spiritual group Falun Gong. Remind us of what this group is and why they appeared to be a threat to the Chinese government.
Well, Falun Gong sprung up in the early 1990s, a period when China was, when Chinese people were looking for some sort of meaning with the collapse of communism, left a spiritual void. It's a quasi-religious system. Some people may debate whether it's a religion or not. I would see it as a kind of religious system. Focused around one man and his book that tells people how to live a good life, and also exercises that help improve one's health. And throughout the 1990s, it just grew and grew, and you couldn't go to a park in Beijing or any other city in the early morning without seeing Falun Gong people practicing. But then they decided to protest in front of the government offices in early 1999 because they felt that there'd been a slight against them in one of the local newspapers, and they wanted the government to quit harassing them. So they protested, and the government banned them.
Your story begins with a woman from the city of Weifang, sort of a mid-sized Chinese city, who attempted the simple act of traveling to Beijing to engage in one of these protests, a small one. Let me tell us just, if you can, that scene where she goes to the capital, a strange place for her, and how does she encounter authority? She's going to go to a park and look for some other followers.
Yeah, people, as I said, had been practicing Falun Gong in parks, and she thought, well, maybe if I go to a park early in the morning, I can find some other practitioners and ask them where we can go and protest. She was quite a naive person, quite a simple person. She'd been in a factory her whole life. She had had very little formal education and was, you know, basically barely literate. So she goes to this park and she's looking around to see, do I see any people practicing Falun Gong? And she's completely out of place here. She's dressed in simple sort of peasant outfit. And these police officers come up to her and ask her, are you an adherent of Falun Gong? And one of the things that Falun Gong teaches is that you're not supposed to lie. And she said, yes, I am.
And that was enough. She was in jail.
That was it. She was detained, yeah.
She ends up eventually, after returning to Beijing a couple of times and is persistent, she ends up in more serious trouble and in this local re-education center. And you learn some rather chilling details about circumstances there. Give us some of that.
Right. She was held in one of these centers, re-education. They were called transformation centers, where they tried to transform you to get you to change your mind, to renounce your belief. And she refused to. They asked her again and again. They held her there. They called her daughter and said, look, you need to come down and get your mother to change her mind. You need to pay a big fine. And the daughter was, at that point, frankly, a little ticked off at her mother. And she couldn't understand, what is up with Mom? Why won't my mother just recant? I mean, what's the big deal? Why does she insist on believing in this thing? And she didn't go down. And so her mother was held another night. They tried to get her again to recant. She wouldn't, and they began to beat her. And I was able to talk to witnesses in the cell and people who had smuggled letters out of prison who describe how she was beaten and ultimately beaten to death.
Now, the repression of the Falun Gong was a national issue for the Chinese government. I mean, it got a lot of attention in the Western media. You wrote about it for the Wall Street Journal. Was the brutality and the killing of Mrs. Chen an aberration? Was it an isolated occurrence?
Well, not really. By conservative estimates, thousands of people were detained for their belief in Falun Gong, and dozens of people were killed. Falun Gong claims that hundreds of people were killed. That's hard to document, but human rights organizations and conservative estimates would show that certainly dozens of people died in police custody.
Now, why was the repression of Falun Gong so brutal in this city of Weifang, where this woman you profiled? Because it seemed that there was a disproportionate number of deaths there. Why was that?
Well, the government used a system that it used actually for economic reforms. It holds the lower level person responsible for fulfilling goals. And it's like that with, say, if you want to reform the economy, you say, well, you have to privatize so many companies. The lower level official actually signs a contract with you and says, okay, I promise to fulfill XYZ goals. And they do it. With Falun Gong, the government called all the provincial leaders to Beijing and said, you have to stop people from coming to Beijing. We don't care what you do. No measure is excessive, to quote the order that they gave, but you just stop people from coming to Beijing and protesting. And so the provincial officials then went down to the county, went down to the city, and on, and just sort of said, you have to stop people from coming from your county, from your city, from your village. And so the local officials just had a very strong interest in preventing anybody from doing anything like that. Now, in this particular city, it's not too far from Beijing, so it was possible for people to take a bus. Some people even rode their bicycles to Beijing, and some people even walked. And so they had a large number of people who were going to Beijing, and then they just implemented very harsh tactics against them. Basically, they just beat the faith out of people. If they didn't repent, if they didn't give up Falun Gong, they were beaten. And several people died.
You actually spoke to some local officials who thought that the repression was a terrible mistake, right?
Yeah, many local officials felt really bad about what had been happening. They knew a lot of the people who were involved, and they thought that this is not the smartest way to handle things, that these people were at worst sort of maybe religiously obsessed or whatever, but they weren't criminals. They didn't need to be thrown in jail and beaten.
And they thought it detracted from other valuable tasks that they needed to be performing, right?
China has so many things that it needs to do. I mean, it still has so many people living in poverty. It's trying to modernize its economy, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot of worthwhile things that the government could be doing with its time rather than cracking down on a religious group.
The Internet's had an enormous democratizing influence, some would argue, throughout the world. I'm wondering, do Chinese have the same access to the kind of range of opinions and material on the Internet, and what's the effect?
Well, I think the first thing one has to remember is that China is still largely a rural country and still very much a poor country, and the Internet use is not that wide, not as wide as in some countries like in the West. But in the cities, it has had an impact, but the material is controlled. Sites are blocked. Anything with sensitive material on human rights or Taiwan or Tibet or any issues like that, they're all blocked. And chat rooms and things like that are often monitored so that there's often a 15 or 30 second delay in a chat room. And if there's anything really bad or something that somebody's written, the government can just snip that out.
When you communicated with the Falun Gong people, you ended up having to send encrypted email, right?
Yeah. You can do that. You can download encryption software off the internet, freeware, and that's an effective way. But you still have to be careful, because if you can still tell where the email was sent from, which computer. So it's still, if the government wants to keep a lid on something, they can still do it despite the internet.
Well, Ian Johnson, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks a lot.
Ian Johnson is the author of Wild Grass, Three Stories of Change in Modern China. Coming up, critic John Powers on two recently released DVDs. This is Fresh Air. Two recent popular films are now out on DVD. Kill Bill Volume 1, which sold 2 million combined DVDs and videos on its first day of release, and Lost in Translation. Critic at large John Powers says these strikingly different movies have a lot in common.
When I was a teenager in Omaha, it drove me crazy that there were movies I could never see. I'd read that Bonnie and Clyde had been influenced by the French New Wave, but films by Truffaut or Godard didn't play in Nebraska. So I couldn't see how until I went off to college. Things are totally different in the DVD era. Now everything is becoming available to everyone. If you can't rent Jules and Jim at your local video store, you can do so by mail, or even buy it for the cost of two tickets to Scooby-Doo 2. And that's not the only change. These days, the biggest jolts of cultural energy no longer come from across the Atlantic. Where the 60s were driven by the British invasion in music and by European art films, American culture today is increasingly excited by Asian pop. From video games and Hello Kitty, who's surpassed Mickey Mouse as the modern icon of cuteness, to the hyperkinetic brio of Hong Kong movies. This influence was striking in two of last year's best American pictures, both of them new to DVD. Now, you hardly have to be a genius to find the Asian theme in Lost in Translation, Sofia Coppola's delicate comedy about the brief chaste fling between Scarlett Johansson's confused young woman and a world-weary movie star played by Bill Murray. After all, the story is set in Tokyo. But what you may not know is that Coppola's movie is filled with the artistic DNA of the Hong Kong director Wong Kar-wai, who is for today's young American filmmakers what Fellini or Bergman was to an earlier generation. In fact, if you liked Lost in Translation in the theater, or on the DVD, you should probably check out the DVDs of Wong's two most popular movies, Chungking Express and In the Mood for Love. Not only are they uncommonly enjoyable, but they're revealing. You'll discover the origin of Coppola's way of shooting Tokyo, and more surprisingly, you'll see the scene that obviously cued Lost in Translation's famous final bit, when Bill Murray whispers something mysterious into Johansson's ear. To Coppola's credit, she hasn't tried to hide Wong's influence. She even named him in her Oscar speech. And her borrowings are far more an act of homage than theft. It's a question of legacy. In fact, she approaches Wong Kar-wai with the same affection as she approaches her star, Bill Murray, who, incidentally, has some delicious behind-the-scenes moments on the DVD. Lost in Translation is also about Murray's legacy. You can feel the decades winding backwards in the triumphant scene when Murray sings karaoke to Johansson, putting a romantic spin on his sleazy lounge singer bit from Saturday Night Live.
I could feel at the time there was no way of knowing fallen leaves in the night. Who can say where they're blowing? As free as the wind, hopefully learning why the sea on the tide has no way of turning. more than this. You know there's nothing more than this.
If Lost in Translation is tinged with urban melancholy, you get the opposite end of the emotional spectrum in Kill Bill Volume 1. It's a revenge story about the bride, played by Uma Thurman, who sets about exacting mortal justice from those who had left her for dead after slaughtering her wedding party. Her search for vengeance takes her to Japan, where she gets involved with Japanese gangsters, or Yakuza. Although this dazzling action picture was the bloodiest movie of 2003, it was also the most obsessed with cinematic legacy. In combining samurai pictures, gangster movies, and Hong Kong chop sake, not to mention old Hollywood westerns, Quentin Tarantino was trying to create the ultimate action film, the Gone with the Wind of Asian exploitation pictures. And to do it, he borrowed freely from earlier movies. Movies like The Street Fighter, starring the great Japanese action star Sonny Chiba, who has a role in Kill Bill. Like Seijin Suzuki's delirious gangster movie Tokyo Drifter, which Tarantino copies in Kill Bill's nightclub climax. And like Battle Royale, which created the psycho schoolgirl Gogo Yubari, who becomes one of the bride's deadliest foes. All of these movies are on DVD. It's always been one enjoyable feature of Asian pop culture that it has a shameless magpie spirit. You steal a little bit here, a little bit there, and you weave it into something new. That's one reason why today's Asian movies have a passion and verve, and a sense of fun, largely missing from so much of today's Hollywood product, which seems to come from a corporate cookie cutter. And that's why young American directors are so turned on by them. The same exuberant spirit animates Kill Bill Volume 1. And like Sofia Coppola, Quentin Tarantino makes no bones about where he got his ideas. He'll cheerfully order you to watch the movies he strip-mined for his film. He doesn't say, "I'm making everything up new." He says, "I'm taking something old and doing something brand new with it." Isn't that really cool?
John Powers is deputy editor and media columnist for LA Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Anne Marie Baldonado directed today's show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
I was 5 and he was 6. We rode on horses made of sticks. He wore black and I wore white. He would always win the fight. Bang, bang, he shot me down. Bang, bang, I hit the ground. Bang, bang, that awful sound. Bang, bang, my baby shot me down.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics, enduring works of literature in newly annotated editions, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Aveda, an earth-conscious beauty company committed to preserving natural resources and finding more sustainable ways of doing business. Information available at aveda.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Bob Woodward on his new book, Plan of Attack, a behind-the-scenes look at how and why the Bush administration decided to wage war in Iraq. Woodward interviewed over 70 government officials for the book, including the president and Colin Powell. I'm Dave Davies. Join us for the next Fresh Air.